Have you ever wished you could sit down and talk with another species, have a real conversation with a dog or an ape? Well, a group of psychologists in the 1970s tried to do just that. They took a baby chimpanzee named Nim, raised him as a human, and taught him sign language. The chimp learned a lot of signs, but was he really communicating? A new documentary looks at that experiment and tells the sad story of what happened to Nim after the project was over. We'll talk to some of the people who participated. Plus, what can a material scientist learn from a seashell? Coming up, looking to nature for material inspiration and trying to teach old organisms new tricks like building solar cells or batteries. And the video pick of the week, farming on a Brooklyn roof, after this.
You can support the show by trying Audible.com with over 75,000 audiobooks, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Science Friday. Now on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. There's something very beguiling about the idea of communication with another species. Clearly, animals possess a kind of intelligence, and they're able to recognize and respond to words. But what are they thinking? What if you could ask them? What if they could answer? In the 1970s, a Columbia University psychology professor tried to answer those questions. He set up an experiment to raise a chimpanzee as a human and teach it sign language. But things didn't go exactly as planned. The story is the subject of a book, Nim Chimpsky, and a new documentary called Project Nim. My guests today played a part in that story and were interviewed for the film. So give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And if you're on Twitter, you can tweet us. We are questions by writing the @ followed by SciFry. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website, www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And now, let me introduce my guests. Jenny Lee was 13 years old when the infant chimpanzee Nim moved into her house and became a part of the family. She's now a landscape architect, and she joins us from WUIS in Springfield. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Bob Ingersoll was a graduate student at the Oklahoma Institute for Primate Studies when Nim was transferred there. He's now the president of Mindy's Memory Primate Sanctuary in Oklahoma, and he joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate you having us on.
And also with us today is John Cohen. He's a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine and the author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. Welcome back to Science Friday, John.
Pleasure to be here, Joe.
Great. So let's start with you, John. What were the basics of Project Nim? What was this setting out to do?
In the 1970s, there were a lot of ape language research programs underway. Maybe on the order of a dozen, where people were trying to see if they could teach English in particular mostly through American Sign Language, but also with tokens and other ways of communicating to chimpanzees and bonobos eventually and gorillas. So Project Nim was Herbert Terrace's effort to see whether he could, by enculturating a chimp, having it live with humans, whether it could learn to communicate with language.
And had there been chimp studies? I mean, was this the first one how long had people been doing this for?
Well, it dates back to the 1890s with a kind of crazy American who went and lived in the jungle in Gabon and tried to speak with chimpanzees, a guy named Richard Lynch Garner. And then there were serious scientific attempts in the 30s and 40s where couples in particular, husband and wife teams, took chimpanzees into their homes and tried to teach them to speak with vocalizations, but they don't have our apparatus. They couldn't do that. And also with sign language. And all of them had some success, but not that much. And everyone kind of hit the wall. Hmm. And in the 60s and 70s, people started to have more and more success.
Okay. Jenny Lee, you were 13. How did your family get involved in this?
My mother had been a student of Dr. Terrace's at Columbia, and she was approached by him when he became interested, I think, in doing a home study with a chimpanzee, and then quite unexpectedly, a chimp was born at the Primate Center in Oklahoma. I guess they hadn't realized that the mother was pregnant, and suddenly the project was on. Mm-hmm. We were sort of informed as a family that we were getting a baby chimp, and needless to say, everyone was quite excited by that. My mother had remarried, and so we were a blended family of seven kids, spanning from about 8 to 15.
Wow.
So it was an exciting moment.
You know, yeah. I was walking down to the NPR studios in New York today, and I walked down Columbus Avenue past 78th Street, where I guess you were living in a brownstone. Is that right?
That's correct.
I guess what I wanted to ask you is, okay, so you're 13 years old, and you go to school, and you tell your friends, hey, we just adopted a chimpanzee. I mean, what was that like?
People were excited, and probably people didn't believe it.
Did they come over?
Really, when can we come over? Yeah. When can we play with him, bring him to school? All of those kind of 13-year-old questions were popping up, I think, amongst all of our friends. And at the very beginning, like any newborn, you don't want to be bringing in a lot of germs and things into the home. So it was more limited. But as he grew up, I did bring him to school one day for a period and to show him off and sort of very fancy show and tell. His time outside was limited in the neighborhood just for more particularly for health reasons. Mm-hmm. And then also it would create a little bit of a stir sometimes.
So Nim starts off in this apartment or this brownstone on West 78th Street. Then he moves up to a large house in Riverdale in the Bronx. And then he winds up back in Oklahoma. And Bob Ingersoll, that's when you get back involved with him or start to become involved with him?
Right. I met him in September of 1977 when Herb Terrace decided that the project was no longer feasible, at least no longer feasible with Nim there. And so they returned Nim to the Institute for Primate Studies where he was born, and that's where I met him.
Could you tell, I mean, from the first time you saw Nim, that this was an animal that had a different skill set than your, most chimpanzees?
Yeah, I actually did. I saw him signing with Bill Tynan and Joyce Butler, and his ability, at least in sign language, to me seemed phenomenal. At least as good as Washa, who I'd been working with for a number of years. So I was impressed. I was also impressed by just how freaked out he was, and just how freaked out Bill and Joyce looked.
Why?
Well, in the sense that he looked pretty traumatized. They both looked, reasonably traumatized by the whole, having to give him back. And he'd never been around other chimps before. So all those things were playing into the situation. But, I was a student, so I just simply stood back and watched what was going on that day.
We're talking with Bob Ingersoll and Jenny Lee, both of whom were involved in Project Nim, although I guess it stopped being a project by the time Bob Ingersoll got involved and became more a life story. And also John Cohn, who's a science writer from Science Magazine and written a book called Almost Chimpanzees. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. And let's take a call now and go to Hal in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Hal, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What's your question? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, since chimps seem to display emotion to their handlers and to their own kind, isn't that a form of language?
Bob Ingersoll, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a form of language. I think that a lot of our communication is in the nonverbal realm, and I think that that at least as far as I'm concerned, that counts as language. There's communication going on, and there's a message being passed back and forth. So I'd consider that at least a form of language or at least one of the tools that language uses to be able to be in rich and full like language is.
But how sophisticated? I mean, if you're expressing happiness or hunger or some primal emotion through, you know, face nonverbal communications or whatever, is that a substantive communication, or is that just, you know, sharing information?
That's definitely sharing information, but then when it's coupled with sign language in a system that we teach them, so not only is the nonverbal going on, but also the sign and the correct context and the correct signs to go along with it, that seems to me to be, you know, an added something that no other animal that I've ever seen can do. I mean, your dog can't do that. Your dog can make you, you know, read all the cues that they give, and you know, but your dog can't use sign language coupled with it in order to get the point across. So I think it's slightly more sophisticated.
Hal, thanks for that. Yeah, go ahead, Jenny.
Jump in 1 second. One of the things that I observed Nim doing at a fairly young, I think he was 3, was using the sign for bite, which was a way of he would express his anger instead of actually biting you. So he was learning to use these signs to express those primal feelings of I'm angry, I'm gonna pissed off at you, you've taken something away from me, and he would sign bite rather than coming charging over, and what he would do in, you know, without using the signs would be to try to bite you as a way of making you do what he wanted you to do, just as any little kid or something might do.
Yeah, that's so. A perfect example of, you know, the exactly what I'm speaking to. So,
go ahead, John Cohen. I was just going to ask: is this language, language as a scientist or a psychologist might describe it?
You know, in the research community, there's a very strict sort of definition of what is language, and they separate language from communication. Those are two separate ideas, and Herbert Terrace's whole project was about language. It wasn't simply about sophisticated communication. We all know that chimpanzees are very smart and that they can communicate at very high levels. But is it language? That's the central question Terrace was addressing. And then how do you define language?
Well, what did Terrace conclude?
Well, Terrace concluded in a 1979 paper that was published in Science, and the question was, can an ape create a sentence? That was the name of the paper, and his conclusion was no, that what they had done with Nim was essentially fooled themselves into believing that Nim was speaking in sentences. But when they reviewed videotapes, and they also reviewed Washoe and Coco the gorilla, they saw that largely the apes were imitating what the researchers were trying to communicate, and that didn't qualify as language. You know, language is grammar. It's a large vocabulary. It's putting ideas inside of ideas called recursion, and children, human children, by the age of 3, are doing this very easily and naturally. And the critical point Terrace was making that upended the entire field was that no ape had done those things.
Okay, John, we have to interrupt you right there because we have to break away for a short break, but we'll come back. We're talking about Project Nim with some of the people who participated and some John Cohen, who's a science writer who's written a great deal about chimpanzees. Stay with us.
This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by Audible.com, which is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Science Friday, Audible is offering a free audiobook of your choice when you try Audible free for 14 days. One audiobook Science Friday listeners might enjoy is Robopocalypse by Daniel H. Wilson. You may remember Dan from a discussion with Ira on a recent episode of the show to discuss his book about robots taking over the world. And you can get Robopocalypse for free on Audible. Another audiobook is The Quantum Story, a history in 40 moments by Jim Baggett. Jim suggests that to have a better understanding of what is happening in science today with the Large Hadron Collider and CERN, you need to know something about the history which precedes them. That's The Quantum Story, a history in 40 moments by Jim Baggett, available on Audible. And if you'd like to see books Ira is listening to now, go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/scifry and check out Ira's Best Listens book list. To try Audible today with a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/sciencefriday. That's audible.com/sciencefriday. Now, back to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about the story of the chimpanzee Nim, who was raised as a human and taught to speak sign language. My guests are Jenny Lee, who grew up with Nim in her household, Bob Ingersoll, who worked with Nim as a graduate student, and they were both in the new documentary Project Nim. Also with us is John Cohen. He's the author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. And I'm sorry, John, I had to cut you off just before the break. Did you want to finish that thought about language?
Well, I think that an important point Terrace was making is that we have to be careful when we look at the dividing line between communication and language. Part of language requires listening, and one of the points Terrace made is that Nim wasn't very good at listening. It wasn't really interested in that level of communication of what we really consider to be language. And so when you look critically at what Nim was doing, I don't doubt for a moment what Bob and Jenny experience that Nim communicated at a very sophisticated level. Is that language? And I think the evidence that Terrace presented in 1979 was compelling that it was not language, and I think it stands till this day with every great ape that has been enculturated by humans and attempted to speak English, for the most part, with sign language.
All right, let's take another call now and go to Jane in Marin County. Jane, you're on Science Friday. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. This is fascinating. I love shows like this, and I love the topic. I'm looking at a October 1978 National Geographic with Coco the gorilla on the front page. He's got a camera in his hands, and he's taking a picture. And I wonder if any of your guests are familiar the woman who reared Coco. Hmm. And taught him sign language, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful story.
Let me ask, do any of you know about Coco at all?
Coco's actually a female, and uh-huh. Yes, I do know about Coco.
Uh-huh.
Yes, she.
Yeah, Coco's actually a replication of the Washoe Project. So Coco was, I believe, was at the San Francisco Zoo and was worked with by Penny Patterson, who now lives here in the Bay Area with Coco and runs the, I believe it's called the Gorilla Foundation, and continues the work with Coco to this day.
Jane, thanks.
I've never met Coco or been around her, but
okay.
I have a friend who met Coco, who actually went down to Palo Alto when they were down there and met Coco and spent some time with her, and it was the most exciting thing that ever happened to my friend in her life.
I think that Coco and Neil Young have actually hung out together from what I've heard here recently.
Wow. Bob, maybe
back in the day.
Maybe you can pick up the Nim story because he came back to Oklahoma and when he was 5 years old, is that right?
Yeah, about five.
And what? How long did he live and what were the later years of his life like?
Well, he was in Oklahoma after he returned for about 5 years, and then unfortunately the institute was, fell on hard times financially, and the chimpanzees were sold to a laboratory in New York called the Laboratory for Experimental Medicine and Surgery in Primates, called LEMSIP. And fortunately for Nim, he was only there for a couple of weeks before he was removed and moved eventually to a place in Texas called the Black Beauty Ranch, where he lived for about a year and a half alone, and then about 85 or so, another chimpanzee named Sally was brought down to Black Beauty Ranch, and they lived together there for about 10 years until Sally died, about the time Sally died is when I came back into Nim's life and spent the next 5 years trying to help him out. We ended up getting a couple of other chimps from LEMSIP to move there and another chimp from the Colston Foundation, so... So he lived till he was 26, and he passed away at the Black Beauty Ranch.
Okay, let's take another call now and go to Tom in Baltimore. Tom, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air. Tom? Okay, that didn't work so well. How about, Peg? Peg in, that's Matt in Roanoke, Virginia. Matt, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I had a question for your psychologist guest. He was just talking about the animals not using human grammar, but it seems like we can't really expect them to. And to what extent an attempt had been made to use animal grammars or to figure out animal grammars. My dog, for instance, bows when she means play, and that's, it seems only reasonable to kind of meet the animals halfway. So I'll take my answer off the
Okay, thanks, Matt. Well, I have to say I'm afraid we don't actually have a psychologist. Bob Ingersoll's an anthropologist, but John, I think that was the point you were making, and you've talked to psychologists, so maybe you can elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, the point that the caller is making is an excellent point. Why are we trying to teach these other species to speak the way we speak? And there have been studies of wild chimpanzees to look at how they communicate with each other to better understand their level of communication. It doesn't appear to be grammar. And grammar has a set of rules that we very early on internalize and learn. There's no strong, compelling evidence that I've ever seen of any species other than humans who live by that set of rules. That doesn't mean that animals in the wild don't communicate with things that even approach words to identify specific predators, let's say. But it's not language. It's not grammar.
Okay. Gary in St. Louis, Missouri, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was studying animal behavior right around this time and actually went down to Oklahoma and met with Washoe and got to play with Nim's brother, who was Onan, which one thing I'm just glad to hear. I hear that he was also spared from medical research. I'd like to know if he's still...
No, that's not true.
Yeah,
well,
but
actually, I can tell you what happened.
During this time, I mean, these were people who really cared about these animals, and I found out more recently that Nim was taken away from his mother pretty much right after birth. That's got to be an awfully traumatic event to a mother chimp. And how did I realize your guys weren't involved in that decision, but how did the people, do you think, justify that traumatic of a thing just for this sort of a study?
Bob Ingersoll, I mean, you weren't there at the very initial phase of this, but what do you make of that idea of taking a baby chimp from its mother?
Well, bad idea, obviously, and traumatizing for the mother and the infant. And I can just jump in on Onan. Unfortunately, Onan did stay at Lemsip for most of the time. Lemsip was open, and then when in the film it depicts Jim Mahoney, who is the lab veterinarian at Lemsip. Actually, Jim and I worked together, and Onan was spared and didn't go into further medical research, and he was moved to a place in Texas called Primarily Primates at about the same time that we got a couple of Nim a couple of chimpanzee buddies. And so, unfortunately, Onan didn't get to see Nim again, but he did get out for a couple of years before he also passed away right around the age of 26. So I don't know. Maybe we actually met. I worked with Onan quite a lot, actually.
Generally, there's something I'm curious about. Now, obviously you've seen this film and you know the story of what happened to Nim after you were involved. You didn't have any role, I'm sure, in deciding to get involved in this. But how do you feel about your involvement at this point?
It's something that I feel very conflicted about, in that the outcome for Nim, as there had really never been a plan. Something at 13 I was completely unaware of, but as Nim matured and one thing led to one thing, and he was taken from our home and taken to Riverdale and taken from there back to Oklahoma and then from Oklahoma to Lemsip, he had become my brother emotionally, and then to be following his life and knowing that it was in some ways going downhill step by step, in terms of being further and further away from what he had known as an infant. Now, one thing that's been wonderful about the film and the book has been being able to meet and sort of reunite with people that were involved in Nim's life. But it's left a very almost shameful – it's something I'm not proud of. Being involved with, and only, it's only since the publication of Elizabeth's book and Elizabeth Hess's book and James Marsh's movie that I've actually started talking about it, because it was traumatic, I think, for all of us, and in different ways, because you form such a tight bond with this creature.
You actually referred to him as a brother, and I wonder if you'd make the distinction. I mean, it's different somehow than a dog or a or some other animal that you might have had who was beloved by the family.
Exactly. Very, very different. A dog is, you know, I love dogs. I have a dog. And they know you. They request things. They ask to play. They ask to go out. But at heart, they're still a dog. They're still an animal that responds sort of instinctually to everything. And Nim was not. Nim was very tuned into the situation, the emotions of the situation. He would, if you were sad or crying or had a fight with my mother or something like that, and he would come and sit on your lap and give you a hug and kiss the little tears away. And in a way that was not the same as, you know, your dog worrying that something was wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the dog is thinking about the dog. Yeah. Nim seemed to be thinking about you. So you were able to form this really amazing bond.
Well, it certainly was a remarkable experience and probably one that won't be repeated very often. But
hopefully
I'm afraid we've run out of time. So first, let me thank you, Jenny Lee. She's a landscape architect based in, is it New York?
In New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Bob Ingersoll is the president of Mindy's Memory Primate Sanctuary in Oklahoma. They were both in the film Project Nim in theaters now. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my buddy Nim.
Okay. And John Cohen is a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine and the author of Almost Chimpanzee, Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
If you look at the material chalk and a precious pearl, chemically, they're pretty similar. But one is soft and the other is hard. One is cheap and the other gets made into jewelry. The difference is in the way the materials are structured, and in the case of the pearl, the way that the materials are assembled by a living organism, building up the pearl layer by layer in just the right way. Or consider the way that tiny organism called diatoms can build complicated shells of glass and do it not with molten glass factory in a factory clean room, but in ocean water at regular temperatures. What does nature know about building stuff that we don't? Well, quite a bit. And can we learn their secrets? Well, I think my next guest thinks maybe we can. She's Angela Belcher, the W.M. Keck Professor of Energy in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering and in the Department of Bioengineering at MIT. And her lab studies ways to use some of those natural tricks to build things humans want, like batteries or solar cells. She joins me from a studio on the MIT campus. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So what got you started in this field?
Well, that was a great introduction. Mm-hmm. I did my PhD on how abalones grow shells, and I was fascinated by the really exquisite structure of the abalone shell. As you mentioned, is made out of chalk, and we're all familiar with chalk, and many of us are probably familiar with abalone shells. Well, if you take that shell structure and you look at it under higher magnification, you basically fracture it and you look at it, what you find is that it's made up of plates of calcium carbonate, plates of chalk that are structured in a way that's quite a bit different than the way that chalk looks. And if you look even closer, you find out, well, it's not all inorganic material. There's a biological component to it, that the organism, the abalone, makes this mostly inorganic material, but it has about 2% by weight of protein. And this protein actually has a huge impact on this material. It has impact on the way this material looks, the beautiful, lustrous structure of pearls or abalone shells. But it also has a big impact on the structure itself. It makes it a tough structure, and the mineral structure, the way the atoms are actually arranged in the structure of this material are quite a bit can be quite a bit different than chalk. It can use one form or another. And to me, that was really fascinating.
We're talking with Angela Belcher about using natural organisms to make incredible things. You can join us at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Science Friday from NPR. So you study these things, and you describe looking at them under the microscope. So now you've got the skill you need is a microscopy skill. You talked about putting down layers. You need a material science skill. You need a chemical skill. What do you bring to the table if you want to study these organisms?
Well, you know, people have actually understood the structure of pearls and shells for quite a while. And it's this combination of biology plus materials and biology plus the inorganic component that make it so valuable. And it's you can look at the shell, and you, like you said, you can look at it under the microscope, but it's after the process has already taken place. What's really interesting is actually the dynamic process, how the organism makes the calcium carbonate, how it makes the material. Because the organism has cells, and these cells are pumping out proteins, and these proteins actually can grab on to ions in solutions, or ions in the ocean, and put them together basically in layers of ions, in groups of ions and atoms, so they build up a structure exactly the way that they need the structure to be, the way that it's actually the strongest and toughest structure, so it can withstand things in the environment, like otters and other kinds of things that would happen in this environment. Mm-hmm. But the thing that's interesting is that it has a DNA sequence. The abalone has a DNA sequence that codes for the ability to string amino acids together in the right order so that it can efficiently and effectively grab what it needs from its environment and starting to build it up atom by atom by atom. And by doing so, produces this structure that has a lot of interesting materials. So to me, as a material scientist and as a biological engineer, you think, you know, what a great system. The organism took what's in its environment and built up a higher value structure. That structure is something very useful. And so you can look at it in an electron microscope under high magnification and look at the structure. But then you can also say, well, you know, how did it make those proteins? How did it secrete those proteins? And why are they specific to be able to grow this particular kind of mineral? And then you can look back even further and you say, well, you know, they have this DNA sequence. They have a sequence encoded in their genome that says this is how to build a great shell. This is how to build it. And so for me, I look at that and I say, okay, if an organism can build a shell, what if we could get simpler organisms to build other things that are more useful to us? If we can have a DNA sequence that codes for a protein sequence to start building materials that could be an electronic material or could be a material that is an interesting catalyst for other kinds of chemical reactions? Or what if you could build a solar cell?
Angela Belcher, you're going to have to give us all the various things that you are now working on to make, but we're going to have to wait and do that after the break. We're talking with Angela Belcher. She's a professor of energy in the Department of Materials Science at MIT, and her lab studies ways to use some natural tricks to make some interesting things. We'll be right back.
No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket.
This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka. We're talking this hour about making materials inspired by nature. I'm talking with Angela Belcher. She's the W.M. Keck Professor of Energy in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering and in the Department of Bioengineering at MIT. And Angela Belcher, you were just about to enumerate assuming that making a better abalone shell is only one of your goals, what else you might be able to get these organisms to do that would be of interest to us?
Well, that's a great point. So we look at abalone shells, and you say, well, abalone have done a fantastic job of making these kinds of structures that I'm personally not interested in building on those structures. And abalone's had about 50 million years to get good at making abalone shells, and so they have a really good head start. Mm-hmm. What we started thinking about was, well, so there's only a couple of elements in the ocean that organisms have started building hard materials out of. And as mentioned before, calcium carbonate, there's calcium phosphate, like our bones. There's some iron structures, iron oxide. And as was mentioned earlier, diatoms made out of silica. What we decided to do was, what if organisms could work with a much larger part of the periodic table? What if we could give them most of the periodic table to work with? And if we could find a DNA sequence that coded for a protein sequence that could grab onto those atoms or those elements and start building them up into useful structures, what would we want to make? And how could biology facilitate that? And so that's what we've been doing pretty much the last 5 or 6 years is trying to make useful devices and useful materials that can have an impact on society. And we've looked at materials for batteries, for energy storage. Can you find a biological sequence that can assemble batteries to make good batteries that are made from environmentally friendly materials that can be made with solution-based processing and assemble themselves?
Hmm.
We've been doing the same thing with solar cells. We had a paper out this year on trying to increase and being able to increase the efficiency of a particular kind of solar cell by using a simple virus that's a bacterial virus that has no effect on humans, giving it the ability to grab on to carbon nanotubes and at the same time to be able to build titania, incorporate into already existing solar cells. So those are two examples that we've been working on.
Well, let's take a call now and go to Benjamin. Benjamin, you're on the air. Benjamin from Girard, Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having such a fascinating topic today. I wanted to ask Angela if, in her work, if she's seen an overlap in the legacy work that Buckminster Fuller had done in his creation of like the geodesic dome, and if she also saw any overlap in her field into like sacred geometry or the golden mean or the number phi, which seems to be reoccurring in all these natural structures.
Hmm. Okay, Gerard, thanks for that. What about that idea?
Well, in terms of the interesting architectures, that's one of the things that we've focused on, and we've used materials, carbon-based materials like buckyballs or carbon nanotubes, which have we didn't look at them as much for the geometry, but because of their really fantastic electronic properties, we've been working with getting organisms to pick them up and organize them into units that are actually useful for us. And that's one of the things that we've done with our solar cells. So, you know, if you look at patterns in biology, I think you'll see a lot of really interesting geometric patterns which go to make materials that are functional. And so I agree with that 100%. I don't really know much about the numbers that you were talking about exactly, but I do know that we really care about numbers of atoms in structures. We're interested in materials that can form with only a small cluster of atoms in a really defined location and defined space to form materials that could self-assemble into larger structures. So this is interesting to us because we work on nanostructure materials and small nanostructure materials. And by controlling which atoms are on the surface or in which layers, it really changes the properties of a material. It can make a material a better catalyst. It can make a material one particular kind of semiconductor versus another that have very useful properties. So I definitely see a correlation and overlap in that. We think of it from the collection and putting atoms together in a very specific way to try to get a particular kind of function we want out.
But I'm curious now, when you're getting these organisms to do their interesting things, are you changing what they have to feed on, or are you trying to change them as well?
We're actually trying to change them. So we mostly use a virus. It's a bacteria virus called M13 bacteriophage, which is
a
virus
that's a pretty catchy name.
Oh, it's a virus that infects just bacteria, and it has single-stranded DNA, and it's surrounded by proteins that its DNA codes for. And what we do is we go into its DNA sequence, and we use basically enzymes, as molecular enzymes, and we cut up the DNA, and we replace it with a random DNA sequence. And using modern molecular biology techniques, this is pretty straightforward to do. And you could basically create a library. If you do that a billion times, you go in and take a DNA sequence and put in a small random DNA sequence in, but do that a billion different times, what you can do is get these viruses are all genetically identical, but they differ from each other based on a small DNA sequence, which corresponds to a small peptide or small protein sequence. And now what you can do is you can have a billion different of these bacterial viruses in just a couple of drops of solution in the lab. And you take those billion possibilities, and we don't know which one is going to be the best for a solar cell. We don't know which one of those is going to be best for a battery. And we say, okay, let's take all billion at once, and let's take a little pipette, and let's drop it onto some battery material and try to force it to interact with that material. The idea goes back to just like an abalone grabs calcium and carbonate out of solution and organizes them into a nice material, let's have the virus grab, if you're doing, say it's iron phosphate, say making a battery, grab the iron and phosphate and start using it and structuring it in a way that would be advantageous for us. And so let's take a billion possibilities and say maybe only 100 out of a billion will have any affinity for our battery electromaterial. So let's get rid of the rest. Let's take that 100 and let's say, okay, now let's make it harder for it to interact. Let's get down to 10. And eventually let's get down to 1. So let's get down to one sequence out of a billion that can grow a battery electrode or that can grow a material for a solar cell. Why do we do a billion years? Why do we do a billion experiments at a time? Because we don't have millions of years of evolution to look for the sequence that works. So let's try a billion experiments at a time and start narrowing it down.
It did sound a bit like evolution there, but it sounds like a using it in a slightly different way. But let's take a call now and go to Carl in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Carl, you're on the air with Science Friday.
Yeah, I was curious on, first off, I love Science Friday. Second of all, I was curious with the idea of trying to manipulate the cells and bacteria, or the, not bacteria, but,
the viruses,
Organisms to try to latch onto other larger molecules, the heavier metals and such like that. Is there a possibility of thought of trying to do that to maybe lock onto like nuclear waste, for instance, like the Nakashima power plant or various other things? And I'll go ahead and take my answer up here.
Okay, thanks, Carl. Go ahead, Angela.
Thanks for that question. And people have been thinking about that more in the last couple of years is can you use natural biological molecules to do things like latch on to molecules that you want to be able to sequester and be able to store and get rid of, like that example. And that's something we've been really interested in. We've looked at it for trying to remove waste from water, for example, to try to pull it out and to chelate it. And that's actually an area that we're getting more interested in going into again, because we've started developing new platforms where we think it could be we could work on a larger scale of trying to remove materials or toxins from the environment. That's a great question. Thank you.
I've read that you've also done some work about trying to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
That's right. We do have a program on carbon capture and storage, and the idea came about again from how abalones can store carbon in calcium carbonate. And we have a project where we've been working on engineering organisms, including yeast, to pull CO2 out of a mock waste from a power plant and convert it into useful materials that you could use as a building materials.
So is this approach something that other scientists have jumped on board with, and are you a bit of an iconoclast in this area?
I think that people have been interested in using biology to make materials for a while, and I think that the way that we do it, it has been repeated by other groups around the world successfully, and people have come up with their own different innovative ideas of doing it. Maybe not just with bacteriophage, but maybe other kinds of viruses or with protein components by themselves or DNA. But they all take into account the idea that biology gives you beautiful structure. It gives you really nice chemical functionality and chemical handles that you can use to grab on to things and bring them together. It uses the idea of solution-based processing and self-assembly and clean manufacturing. So I'm pretty proud of what my group has done in terms of, you know, developing the technology and then using it to actually make real devices that you can hold in your hand. But there's been a great increase in interest in it in the last couple of years.
Care to predict when the first one will come on the market?
When the first...
The marketable device.
Yeah, so I was fortunate to be a founder of a company called Celoria Technologies that's in San Francisco, and they've taken some of the biological technologies that we developed in the lab, some of the platform, and taken into a startup company, which has just done a really fantastic job of combining the biological technologies that we developed with chemical combinatorial chemistry. So adding basically a way of adding lots of different elements and lots of different chemistries into the system. So it's kind of taking the power of biology and the power of combinatorial chemistry and then combining that with rapid throughput screening to look for new materials, catalytic materials that could be used in the chemical industry and in the fuel industry. And, you know, I hate to put a prediction on the time to commercialization, but I can tell you that they're going very rapidly, and it's you know, taking the different powerful techniques and combining them together in a very unique way that enable them to develop new catalysts for some pretty important chemical reactions. One of which is called the oxidative coupling of methane, which is taking a methane, which is just a carbon with a single carbon, and adding more carbons to it in a way that is much higher value to build materials up from methane into materials that could be specialty chemicals and plastics and even fuel.
All right. Well, we'll be watching for that. Thanks very much, Angela Belcher. She's the W.M. Keck Professor of Energy in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering and the Department of Bioengineering at MIT. This is Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. And now Flora Lichtman joins us for Video Pick of the Week. It feels like there should be some music for that, doesn't it? I mean, not, you know, something.
Bum, bum, bum,
yeah, you need a
bum,
theme song, Flora.
Something like that.
Okay, so what's the pick this week?
The pick this week is a profile of a little New York farm. There's chickens and kale and chard, and you're probably thinking, ho-hum, I've seen a farm before.
Yes,
but
I've seen a farm before.
You may not have seen a farm like this. Mm-hmm. The backdrop is not rolling hills or anything pristine. It's New York City. So this farm is located on top of a warehouse in Brooklyn.
I don't understand. I've seen the tops of warehouses. Things do not grow on the tops of warehouses. They have concrete or asphalt or something.
Or whatever, something yucky.
Right.
So it turns out if you put down a protective root barrier and some soil, you can grow vegetables on top of a roof. And it's called a green roof. And actually, I should say that Aleshu Bayak, who's a producer at Science Friday, he's behind this video this week. And he investigated this farm, the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in Brooklyn. And he found out all about green roofs. Now, this is a pretty intensive green roof.
Right. Okay. So what's a green? I mean, I understand it's green because things are growing on it. But what's, apart from having a space to have grow some vegetables in the city, is there another advantage to doing something like this?
There do seem to be other advantages. It insulates the building, we heard on this shoot. So it keeps it warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer. And roofs get really hot in the summer, apparently. And the temperature stays pretty cool up there. So that's another advantage. And it turns out that for 4 inches of soil, it will absorb 1 inch of rainwater. So that's good for the sewer systems as well. So this is sort of, it seems like a prototype of what you might do with a roof, but kind of unusual.
Yeah, I get the feeling. I mean, it's an interesting direction, but is it really? It's not going to save the planet, I don't think.
Well, I think that Annie Novak might disagree with you there, Joe.
Really? Well, okay. I mean, so she hopes to do a lot of these and see them spread far and wide.
I think she hopes that more will sprout up.
Ooh, all
sorry.
Right. That's a good place to end. I think anybody who hasn't left us already should at least know that this
is
the end of the hour.
Well, it is the end of the hour, yeah.
That's right. Okay, thanks, Flora.
Thanks, Joe.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.